thank you all for braving this panel for a couple reasons. One, it's a controversial topic. And two, I'm going to be chairing and presenting. So yell at me if I go over my own time, but I'm going to try to, like, you know, be consistent. And I just wanted to frame this a little bit by saying that the purpose of this panel is to introduce and hopefully work through some of the issues of military actors in the humanitarian innovation discussion. We've heard a lot about partnerships, collaboration. At the opening session yesterday, we talked about reaching as far away as particle physics to bring into the humanitarian discussion, but not the word military. In fact, in my knowledge, it hasn't come up more than once or twice in this conference to date. There are serious challenges, and there are also opportunities with military actors in humanitarian space as it relates to innovation. And the main point here is to help us identify and maybe start problematizing and sticking our teeth into some of the unstated boundaries of what humanitarian innovation is really willing to entertain in terms of cross-fertilization. My name is Josiah. I'm a research officer at the Humanitarian Innovation Project, and I'm overseeing a new exploratory stream of research on this subject. And I'm delighted to introduce my co-panelists, but perhaps they could introduce themselves probably more articulately.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for coming to this panel. My name is Jim Ryan. I'm a little bit of a curate's egg. Bit of this, a little bit of that, I'm not quite sure what I am. I've had two distinct backgrounds, which makes me slightly schizophrenic. I joined the Army at 19 as a medical student, and I had a full career finishing up as chair of the Department of Surgery, and then our Prime Minister of the day, Mrs. Thatcher, closed all the hospitals down, civilian as well as a professor of nothing overnight. Guess what? I crossed the road and joined the humanitarians. I went to UCL, which was at that time setting up an academic department of humanitarian medicine, the idea being to spy on the NGOs to see what they were doing. The question that my dean was asking is what rules do they play by? Mm. How do they do their business? Who measures them? Mm. Who is there any oversight? Is it evidence-based? All of those questions. The NGOs did not like that at all initially, but they came to accept us. So I've got kind of a split brain. I've got a baby eater side, military side, and a pre-hawker side. And I'm going to talk about a civic, a novel aspect of civic that I encountered about 20 years ago.
And I'm Nathaniel Raymond, director of the SIGMO program on human security and technology at Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. I'm also an advisor to UN mission in South Sudan Department of Peacekeeping Operations in the Joint Mission Analysis Center, which, though we don't use the I word, is the intelligence component or the analysis unit of UN peacekeeping missions. And I also have done training with Pacific Command and DOD with ASEAN in disaster response. And I was formerly an invited advisor on humanitarian operations to NATO until I resigned 72 hours after. What I'm going to talk about, because a lot of what I do in my day job is related to satellite imagery and research and development around the use of geospatial technologies and sensors, I'm going to talk about sort of three areas of innovation. And I guess innovation is the word. That's going to be part of what I'm going to discuss. But ways in which humanitarians are the problem with a lot of what's happening in technological innovation now. Ways in which the military is the problem, particularly around R&D. So the question there is, are we engaged in research and development for military applications without really knowing it? And then the third is where we're all the problem. Looking at ground experience that I've had in terms of where military operations have created problems for humanitarians, and humanitarians have responded in a way that creates more problems for everybody.
Great. So thank you. My sincere thanks and appreciation to my co-panelists, because what I'm hoping to do is present some ideas and have them challenge and have you guys challenge them as well, so we can kind of stress test some of the assumptions. But allow me now to shift from my opening remarks to my presentation. What I'd like to do today is present a brief call for greater recognition and new thinking about military actors as a subject of study critical engagement and debate within the current humanitarian innovation dialogue. It's my hope that in doing so, we can set the stage a bit and spark some wider discussion here today around a sensitive, controversial, but I think important topic. And that's a discussion that's going to be added to greatly by my co-panelists following talks. I'm not going to spend too much time today recapping the general humanitarian innovation debate, which should have percolated in by now. But I'd like to begin with a focus on the idea of humanitarian innovation partnerships and the importance in particular of greater engagement with non-traditional partners operating in the humanitarian innovation ecosystem when it comes to innovation. As you can see, this is becoming quite a crowded operating space. But that crowding comes with some opportunities. There's now a widespread acknowledgement that for humanitarian organizations looking to advance their own innovation agendas, non-traditional sources of new ideas, good practice, resources, and in certain circumstances, even burden sharing are possible. And this is something you've been hearing about a lot the last couple of days. To date, however, most of the concerted efforts, sorry, it's a little bit of a small font,
it's tough to see,
that's as private organizations. So most of the concerted efforts to date have been engaging with the private sector in collaboration around innovation. That's not a problem per se. It's brought in a lot of co-development of products and processes, transferable lessons and guidance. But there's a risk that other types of actors in this wider humanitarian ecosystem have been under-engaged with within the humanitarian innovation agenda. And I would suggest that militaries, and that says military over there, have fallen into this category. They've been largely left out of the discussion until recently. I don't think this should surprise anyone here. First, there's been a long history of engagement with military humanitarians dating back to the start of the humanitarian enterprise, but that relationship has shifted in the last several decades. And as the presence of military actors in humanitarian space has grown dramatically, members of the humanitarian community have conversely grown concerned that the key principles of humanitarian impartiality and neutrality, which guide and define their work, are increasingly jeopardized. This is particularly true in conflict situations, but it's also applicable across the emergency spectrum. And as many of you may be personally aware from your own practice and experience, these issues are complex, they're contentious, they're at times very emotive, and they're very far from being resolved. So the topic of civil-military coordination is something we could have a whole conference on, and that's not really the point of this discussion, although it does relate to it. But I think it's fair to surmise that this general discomfort often extends or even prompts discussions around what we can and can't do with knowledge exchange, sometimes for very good reasons. I also think militaries are just not a natural reference point for humanitarian innovators. As an option of last resort, they're very good for lift capacity, they're very good for helping out with ISR, command, control, and communication, engineering, medicine, demining. But outside of these categories that humanitarians feel most comfortable placing militaries, they've not necessarily seen them as providers of innovative lessons, good practice, new ideas, or inspiration. And it's despite this relationship being challenged by new contingencies, such as the very public call by MSF for military assistance during the Ebola response. So my favorite question in academia is, so what? Why should we care in the humanitarian innovation debate about militaries? Well, first, and perhaps most simply, I'd argue that there's a clear and underrealized potential for taking better advantage of synergistic learning opportunities between military and humanitarian actors. But that these opportunities need to be better mapped, better understood, and better problematized before we can actually engage. And second, there are certain military technologies and processes that are already diffusing into humanitarian space. And you hear a lot about drones, UAVs, or unmanned aerial systems, depending on who you're talking to. And that's taken a lot of the oxygen. But there's actually a much broader range of diffusions. And that's currently not being engaged with nearly enough critical scholarship that attempts to ask questions about what this means for humanitarians and what this is doing to humanitarianism. So two sets of issues, one practical, the other critical. Let me take both in turn briefly. We already know from innovation theory, as we've just said, that cross-fertilization is essential for introducing new ideas to a closed network, home affiliate, if you're familiar with the concept. And there's been a small body of analysis that sought to at least raise the idea that militaries might have some good ideas in their practice. In particular, I'm indebted to the work of Randolph Kent and his Human Humanitarian Futures Project, Nathaniel and his colleagues at the Harvard Signals Program for raising this. Deloitte recently published a piece. Some of you may have attended the Knowledge Exchange panel yesterday. And myself and my colleagues here at Oxford were joined by Evan Easton Calabria, who is assisting me with research. We're also working on exploring this a bit. This work gives us some starting premises to at least suggest there might be something here. For one, we have 20 years of very deep, well-developed academic scholarship on military innovation that says militaries take innovation seriously. It's at the core of what they do. They don't always do it well, and they often have a real hard time or are structurally incapable of translating those or scaling those, but it's very active. And also the militaries approach innovation in distinct ways. There are certain strengths military organizations have. They tend to emphasize organizational culture of learning, or at least make an attempt to. They tend to emphasize or at least dedicate resources to knowledge management and diffusion, good practices and lessons learned, or at least attempt to. And they often enjoy a stronger centralized spine of institutional support for innovation than we may see in analogous UN agencies like UNHCR or UNICEF. So this is why Thomas Weiss has written that while humanitarians, quote, will undoubtedly take offense with this generalization, military organizations tend to better value learning and they invest more substantial resources in institutional infrastructure to assemble and act on lessons, and that these essential cultural differences represent models humanitarians should consider emulating, end quote. It's also very important to emphasize that militaries regularly serve as the worst practice examples on how not to do innovation. And they have intrinsic cultures of conformity and tradition, risk aversion, and bureaucratic inertia, which kills innovation dead. I'm sure anyone who's worked alongside or within a military can attest to that. But these still give us valuable lessons. In fact, you could argue the entirety of military history is replete with valuable lessons about how innovation works and doesn't work in rules-heavy organizations. Again, UN has identified innovation as an agenda. Where are there analogous sectors? There's also a simple fact that military operations frequently are occurring and incurring increasingly in austere environments, in the same operating spaces, identical operating spaces, as humanitarians. And as a result, their innovation agendas are increasingly oriented towards overcoming many of the same operational challenges humanitarians face, albeit for widely different incentives. More on that in a moment. But you can also see this in the commitment to innovation at the scale of resources, complexity, and sophistication that goes into RDT&E, research, development, testing, and evaluation. Humanitarians, Deloitte just calculated this, and if you add in the Humanitarian Innovation Fund, which they left out, it's $16.25 million a year invested on innovation. That's not R&D. That's innovation writ large. The U.S. military puts $63.5 billion dollars a year into research, development, testing, and evaluation. That's about 5.4% of all discretionary U.S. federal funding, writ large. It's a massive scale. And it's big business. Defense RDT&E leverages support from multiple innovation partners, industry, universities, private firms, nonprofits, federally financed research and development centers. And this is the extremely ominous, extremely contentious military-industrial complex, or defense-industrial base. And putting aside the many issues with this entity, it's uncontrovertibly massive in scale. In 2014, for instance, Lockheed Martin received $26.9 billion from DOD, a sizable portion of which went to RDT&E. A lot of the innovation output here has nothing to do with the humanitarian sector, unless MSF is in the market for an F-35, which I don't think they would be.
In fact, it would have been rather useful during the voter emergency.
We'll put you in touch, yeah. But critically, this innovation agenda is also increasingly converging with many of the same technologies that humanitarians are prioritizing. As governments turn their strategic orientation, and along with it, their defense priorities, to some kind of securitization of global challenges we heard from this morning's keynote. And you see that in, quote, U.S. National Security Policy 2015 has the word humanitarian right there. Again, this could fill weeks of discussion about CivMil, but focusing in on innovation, the result is a growing range of innovation outputs with potential dual-use applications and a number of analogous reference points and case studies to draw on in building collective understanding. The NGO Military Contact Group, headed by the British Red Cross and the Key Point Engagement, at least on this side of the pond, recently said, quote, "There could be real benefits for the civil-military community and enhance scientific, military, civilian, humanitarian discussions about innovation, about managing risk, and about planning. The problem is there's been very little systematic effort to understand what opportunities exist and what the problems are. We haven't really systematically surveyed what's out there in the military innovation knowledge base in terms of products and process innovations. I say we in terms of the humanitarian innovation discourse and scholarship. This could have been done already, and that's one of the things I'm looking to identify. I think humanitarians and academics often overlook the genealogy of a lot of innovations that have already diffused from military space. We talk about drones to a blue in the face, but permethrin, if you ever sprayed bug spray, log frames, you have the military to thank or blame for log frames, or after action reviews, all from the U.S. Army. What else is out there, though? We need a systematic mapping and framework. What I'm about to share is an extremely ad hoc preliminary set of areas we could start looking. This is not the same as a systematic mapping, but what sectors? Well, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, I'll leave that to Nathaniel to talk on much more authoritatively, but this is about applications of specific technologies, I think more importantly, methodologies for streamlining and fusing intelligence, and also the use of remote sensing. It's also command, control, and communications, the idea of rapid stand-up ICT in austere environments, hardened communication networks, cybersecurity, encryption, things that humanitarians are coming to terms with, logistics, supply chain, procurement management. Often militaries are extremely creative in the strategies they use for getting over disrupted supply chains, circumventing logistical challenges. Something that has nothing to do with equipment or material objects is risk planning and horizon scanning. Most NGOs, most humanitarian organizations still have a one-year window for strategic planning, even though there's a new initiative and movement towards intelligence-led risk management. We're a long way off. Militaries, by comparison, have well-developed risk planning and horizon scanning models. U.S. Army's Training and Doctrine Analysis Center, TRAC, or the DCDC, Defense Concepts and Doctrine Center in the British Army. Simulation and gaming, which we're just speaking about in the beginning of this talk, very advanced simulation, growing methodologies of the use of developed scenarios, clear ideas about stress testing coordination mechanisms, stress testing down to individual psychology, as Jim was just mentioning, and approaches at a meta level to innovation and knowledge management. Some of you here might be familiar with DARPA, the kind of mad scientist lab in the U.S., military, the U.S. defense sector. It gets a lot of hype, some of it real, some of it not, but they are mandated with high-risk, high-payoff technologies. They're given significant authority with minimal long-term responsibility, large budgets, strong institutional support, and top cover. This is, I think, one of the examples the U.S. government at least has come up with for how to manage risk in institute and innovation culture. It can be challenged and problematized, but it's a model to be studied. Of course, there are specific sectors of practice. I'll let Jim speak on this much more thoroughly, but when you look at the diffusion of knowledge base in trauma and A&E medicine, huge amounts are coming from the military because that's, you know, for the history of warfare, what killed more combat fatalities, correct, than combat. So we're currently mapping that. Miriam Orcutt, who you heard speak this morning, is also working on this. And there's a huge range of technologies, knowledge. A lot of the foundation for Ebola vaccines came from military bioweapon biodefense R&D, which for decades was the only source out there actually worried about Ebola. So, again, the NGO Civil Military Contact Group has written that there may indeed be real tangible benefits for populations on the ground, particularly sharing information between scientific and research sides of the organization. Fine. I think that's relatively uncontroversial, although it can be problematized. But that's not the real research question. That's not enough to really get a conversation going. That's mapping and inventory. The real question is, what can be transferred Can it be transferred? Can it be transferred safely in accordance with humanitarian principles? And what is it going to do to humanitarians, cost-benefit-wise? I think on the issue of facilitation, we need to thread a very fine needle between exploring the potential for collaborations that, on the one hand, give humanitarian innovators access to the new ideas, inspirations, and models and resources, potentially, of the military innovation community, while also, first and foremost, preserving humanitarian neutrality and independence throughout all stages of the process. Not an easy task. Can it even be done? This is not a debate or discussion we've had in the humanitarian innovation discussion till literally right now this afternoon. Thank you. And I shouldn't say that because I risk actually neglecting any dialogue that has occurred along this line. Actually, let me be much more humble about that. This is the first time we in Oxford have identified an opportunity to talk about this. But one thing we're hoping is to link up with existing work. At the same time, I think it's important to not see this in absolutes. There may be a middle ground here between learning from ideas military has and not seconding a military officer in every innovation discussion and really spooking a lot of people. I think we need to consider the fact that more cautious and low-risk options, such as analyzing case studies of particularly promising military innovations at arm's length by academics, by humanitarians, away, far away from sensitive context, I don't see why that wouldn't be feasible, but that's something we can discuss as well. And there are a few pre-existing models to give us an idea about how civ-mil engagement might work around knowledge exchange. We have, as I mentioned, the NGO Civil Military Contact Group, the work of Interaction and USIP in America. The Humanitarian Futures Program at King's has identified the idea of technology transfer offices, which are run by governments to encourage the diffusion from defense R&D to the private sector. Such as the U.S. Federal Laboratories Consortium or the U.K. Defense Science and Technologies Lab, DSTL. These are already pre-existing institutional entry points for engagement with governments and their defense industries. Not saying that would work. I'm saying that's a starting point to consider. And, of course, just very briefly, I think many of us here who have been in the field have, at the field level, experienced working and seen soldiers and aid workers forming collaborative ad hoc innovation mechanisms. I worked briefly in Haiti and saw the Joint Operations Tasking Center, JOTC, as a mechanism of necessity that brought members of the U.S. military, MINUSTA, and aid workers into a very uneasy relationship around a table to divvy up requests for physical security. But that was an innovation at the ground level. And there are countless organic instances of innovation and knowledge exchange in the field. I think academia also may have an important role to play here in facilitating as a neutral space. But this brings me to probably what I want to emphasize most in this talk, which is that, perhaps most importantly, the active and passive diffusion of innovations from military to humanitarian space, and we should consider vice versa, what militaries are learning from humanitarians, have some very concerning aspects to call urgently for far more critical research engagement than has been produced to date. There's a significant but little understood political economy, for instance, behind the rise of humanitarian technology. We heard about political economy at a global scale in the previous panel that I hardly overran, and I apologize for that. But there's a big industry and surveillance industry, military industry and surveillance industry, that are looking for new markets in the branding of legitimacy that partnering with humanitarian actors can provide, pushed by both political and profit-driven reasons. This is without even touching on the issue of military contractors, private military, and private security, but we can get into that later. Some authors, such as Kirsten Sandvik of PRIO, have begun to unpack some of these questions, with particular focus on emerging network technologies like big data use and also UAVs. This work has identified some pressing questions, such as the influence of development and marketing strategies on the formulation of regulatory efforts around emerging tech and the processes of labeling and legitimization of new technologies. But more work is needed. We went to 8X this year, for instance. It was really striking how many suppliers of humanitarian kit also sold to the military or militaries, and how very sensitive and aware they were about keeping the branding separate. More critically, scholarship might explore the constitutive identity of humanitarianism and military technology. What does adopting military ideas, processes, ways of thinking, and, of course, equipment due to the intrinsic identity of what it means to be a humanitarian. And I think Nathaniel might be able to touch better on that than me, but it's really a question of asking not only what does new kit and new equipment do for humanitarians, what does it do to humanitarians? That's not just about military diffusion. That's a relevant question across the entire humanitarian innovation discussion. We can unpack that a bit more. And there's an obvious question of ethics. Can this be done ethically? Can we develop any ethical frameworks to guide the application of principles for sharing or engaging the military? Is this a non-starter? So I think in sum, just to wrap up and keep to my own promise, there's two parallel lines of complementary research questions. There's the kind of policy-oriented, pragmatic question of mapping points of synergy and asking how to facilitate them. And there's a critical and reflexive avenue on considering how profit, politics, power, and unintended consequences shape and are shaped by military innovations in the humanitarian space. I've only had time to present the crudest outlines here. I've been reductionist. I'm really only drawn from examples from the U.S. and British military. There are, of course, many, many others, both in the global north and the global south, where militaries operate often as first responders. And I think there's a lot more to be done. What I'm really excited about is this is the first time I've been able to get folks into one room to talk about it. So I'm extremely interested in your responses. I think I'm going to wrap up there and turn the floor over to Nathaniel. It's okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'm going to tell two very short stories just to get going here. So it's 2005 in Sri Lanka. I'm there for Oxfam as part of the tsunami response. The eastern side of the island is devastated. U.S. Marines have just come in. And a French logistician, very silent man, is standing on our porch at Oxfam headquarters, intensely chain-smoking. A U.S. Marine Chinook comes up, pulling a bulldozer underneath it, and it's swinging, nearly hitting our headquarters, knocking off the tops of trees. And he's standing there quietly, and he goes, "What I would give for such lift capacity." And so I tell that story to illustrate one tension, which is humanitarians often look at what militaries have and say, "Ooh, I want that." And it's very attractive. On the other hand, another quick story. I was in Juba a couple weeks ago at a meeting at OCHA wearing my Harvard Humanitarian Initiative t-shirt, but also wearing my Unmiss lanyard. And my meeting finishes up, and I go to the motor pool to try to get a ride back to Tamping Air Base, where we are, where the military side is living. And young humanitarian hops out of his Land Cruiser, and I said, "Hey, can your driver give me a ride back?" He's like, "Sorry, mate, I'm a humanitarian." And I said, "Why? Well, I'm a humanitarian." And he's like, "No, wrong lanyard." And so I'm standing there in the motor pool, unable to get a ride, and it creates this big blow-up about no one wanting to give me a ride because of the lanyard. And it ends up with a moment where, you know, this gets back to UNMISS, that they're not giving UNMISS people a ride. And the line from one soldier is, "Well, they're going to want a ride on our helicopter when we're the last one out." I raise that to show two issues. On one hand, we want certain things as humanitarian actors that militaries have. They want things from us, and I'm going to describe what they are. On the other hand, we want to create lines. We need to create lines. But the way in which we put those lines in practice is often arbitrary, often ritualistic, and often symbolic. It doesn't mean that those lines are wrong, but it means we do need to have a critical and honest inquiry about whether the space we are in, especially in terms of its ambiguities, is accurately reflected by when and where we do show the lines, and also when and where, in terms of civil-military space, we do not show the lines, or even though there might be a line. So let me give you an example. In terms of the first 50 years of the post-World War II humanitarian project, it was really the military, and to allude to some of the points Josiah made, it was really the military that was the center of innovation for humanitarian applications in terms of scale and impact. So, Jeeps. Military medicine, which Jim will go into. Going forward into, in particular, comms, internet, GPS, long-distance radio, satellites, drones. Now, what are the heuristics that these innovations have in common? Well, they speak exactly to the core needs of humanitarians, which is they were coordinative technologies. How do you run logistics over a diverse group in a large area? They were lift-focused. How do you move stuff? And they were about situational awareness. And now, as we move forward into the digital age, you have this sort of what I would call acceptance. So I want to lay out two ideas. You have an acceptance pipeline by which seemingly threatening military technologies over time go through an acceptance process. And it's very, there's been no scholarship really on this. And why, and we're seeing it now with drones, okay? And we're adopting drones in a very sometimes uncritical way where an acceptance process is going on, which we're not documenting. Why 5 years ago was this drone verboten, and now you go to this disaster over the WFP facility like it's normal? How does that normalization and acceptance pipeline constitute itself? And why aren't we looking at it more? The other concept I want to put in here is the double door. When is the door swinging with military innovation going to humanitarians? And how do we detect when the door starts to swing the other way and why? So I want to lay out why I think the door just went whoop from humanitarians towards the military. It's because up until now, when they were doing the big, as I said, coordinative lift and situational awareness technologies, we were never going to build a satellite. If we were, it'd be like a Gilligan's Island satellite, out of bamboo and grass. But we actually were building something else, which didn't matter to the degree it matters now. We were building the data and knowledge to make targeting sensors better. And what I mean by that is now that we've moved into a space where humanitarians, and I'm not going to sit here and be objective, I do this work for a living. I mean, we're building algorithms to better understand and automatically detect certain populations for purposes of human security. Well, that type of work can be reverse engineered in two ways. One is target acquisition, and one is target differentiation. Now, in the military context, they weren't focused. They had a gun sight mentality in terms of sensors. I want to find the thing that matches the thing, and I want to put a rocket on top of it. But suddenly, we are dealing with the military being deployed, and I'm saying U.S. and NATO, in contexts where humanitarian knowledge that is being operationalized into sensor packages for us to have situational awareness is creating unique capabilities that they themselves, through R&D, are not as good at as we are. And I don't think that's being examined. And underlying it is this proposition that is really uncontested. So I said before that, hey, mate, I'm a humanitarian, okay, line drawn, but very critical operationalized view by this guy. You can't get in here because there's an impact on my civil military space. But we're taking donations constantly from governments and defense contractors, donations of data. We are becoming data donor reliant to run some of our core tech programs. I say that as having taken $16 million in kind from Digital Globe to do Satellite Sentinel. Who's their main customer? The U.S. military, U.S. intelligence services. How do we make those decisions on what we take, how we structure those partnerships in context to the four core principles of independence, impartiality, humanity, and neutrality? And so we're just becoming reliant on this data donor side and also this tech side, which is inherently an R&D partnership, whether we recognize it or not. It's a R&D and publicity partnership for defense contractors and for-profit corporations. That is not necessarily bad, but it's bad if you're not having a framework by which we can say, okay, this is all right for me to engage. This is not all right for me to engage. And where it really comes down to is we don't have a theory of needs assessment, okay, on impartiality. We don't know how to do telegeographic needs assessment or ICT-related needs assessment for a population. So what that means is we take what's ever available, right? And I said this in yesterday's talk. We want to do Gaza. But the data donor providers, including militaries and governments, say, well, we don't want you to do Gaza. Vanuatu, go do a cyclone. We feel really comfortable with the cyclone. And suddenly, what was a project on Gaza becomes a project on a cyclone response. And that's happening without us considering it through doctrine. And so we get into this debate about whether it's an okay thing to do rather than the way, whether the way we are doing it is humanitarian or not. And I think also we have to look critically at the way in which when we adopt a technology, we assume that we should be adopting it. Let me give you an example, and Josh Lyons, my colleague from Human Rights Watch, who was on our panel yesterday, brought up the issue of all the blue-on-blue. Does everyone know what blue-on-blue is? So a military term is when friendly fire.
Aim aside.
Yes, exactly. And so blue, right now we have several known incidents in Yemen, for example, but also in Israel and Palestine, of friendly fire on humanitarian facilities based on, it appears in some cases, humanitarians not knowing how to use GPS. And so we're adopting technologies. We're putting things into place without training regimens that are equal to the type of training regimens in a military context. And often those technologies, in the case of GPS, are being used for our differentiation and protection. We have no way of assessing whether that's being done to a certain standard, and we have no way of assessing also, conversely, how that information is being used by the militaries we're giving it to for differentiation. So I'm not trying to solve all the problems in the world here. I'm just trying to articulate that we have some, and they are new. And I think, just to give you an example, we at the Signal program, we are constantly being approached by the U.S. government and by different R&D, you know, you mentioned some of them, R&D outfits of the U.S. government, deeply interested in how we can help them build, quote, HADR technologies, humanitarian assistance and disaster response technologies. That is in itself not a bad thing. But the point is that we hold ourselves to the Red Cross NGO code of conduct in terms of how we approach our research because we work with humanitarians and we do humanitarian-related research. The two big questions come out of this. One is how do I operationalize that code when I am being encountered by, quote, an opportunity for life-saving research with the government? How do I evaluate that? The second is what I'm doing research? Is what I'm doing situational awareness? Is what I'm doing actually aid? And right now, information, communication, technology is not considered one of the basic needs. Okay, now in 2013, you had Humanitarianism and Networked Age up there.
Yeah.
OCHA, in the release of that report, made the conclusion that information and technology was becoming a basic humanitarian need. And I believe it's not only a basic humanitarian need, it's also a basic human right. But in our doctrine, we have this big blind spot on ICT, where it's not a defined need. And you can't blow up a hospital under international law, but if you're Bashar al-Assad, you can shut off a cell network. The reason I mention this is that we, both for militaries and for NGOs, we have not determined when we're doing aid related to these technologies. We have not, but we're beginning to become providers. We're trying to set up cell connectivity. We're trying to do things that militaries do after a disaster. And we don't have minimum standards. We don't have the principal application. And we also don't label it as what we are doing, that we are now service providers in some cases of situational awareness and technologies. And so if we are to get to a point where we can have the civ-mil dialogue on these issues, there's one part we've got to figure out, which is this aid? When is it aid? What principles apply? Second, we have to be able to create glove boxes with the military where it's not, hey, mate, you can't get in the car. Because not having the critical discussion is worse because it forces ad hoc workarounds. And so I'm saying we need glove boxes, we need aid and principle definition and doctrine, and then lastly, we need a process for ascertaining when we build something how it can be reverse engineered and how we make ethical decisions about whether we should even build it at all. That's all I got.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Absolutely fascinating, and tons to come back to. Jim, are you okay with your PowerPoint?
Yes, I just put it over to you. Hello again. I'm going to do something completely different. I'm going to take you on what was a totally unexpected journey. Let me just get my presentation up. As I've got a one-armed bandit of a brain, do you time? Do you just?
I've got you. You're rolling.
Oh, thank you very much.
Got little cards ready.
No. Oh, I haven't looked. What's that? It's not me.
It's on
Cook's stoves. It's from yesterday.
It's a very interdisciplinary.
Oh, here I am. Here, that's it. I've got a one-armed bandit of a brain. Wait, it's ahead of me.
Press F.
Yeah, go to there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's my age in technology. I'm Jim Ryan. I am a professor emeritus at St. George's University, and I basically run or help to run a center for trauma, conflict, catastrophe medicine for the medical students. It is a mixed military civil faculty, so it's another example of semi, but not the one I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about something called the DMCC, which is the Diploma for Medical Care and Catastrophes. It's a diploma that's been running for 25 years, and basically it's set out to be an entirely military initiative, but evolved and changed very rapidly, sometimes with resistance. I've already introduced myself, so I'll move on. My background in giving this presentation is that I've, as I said in my introduction, I had a very, very extensive military experience over about 30 years, then crossed the street. Still had a reserve commitment, so I get called for various, as with the United States military operations, but now I started to basically put my, dip my toe into the humanitarian pool, if you will, and sometimes viewed very suspiciously by my humanitarian colleagues. So let's look at this diploma and see how it evolved and see how it is, I think, a very useful example of civil-military collaboration where barriers have been broken down, trust has been built, and education has been shared and knowledge is diffused, but not easily. The Society of Apothecaries is an interesting organization. It's one of the London livery companies. It's been around since 1617. Its purpose is medical education, but it is nevertheless a livery company. It used to, in fact, grant medical degrees, and curiously, if you failed your MD in your university, you could out of the society and do a sit there exam and become an apothecary and a doctor. They don't do that anymore, but they do basically in their lovely hall here in the centre of London grant postgraduate diplomas. That's what they specialise in now. You see quite a long list. You see the little one in yellow there in 1993. That's just basically 22 years ago, diploma in medical care of catastrophes. How and why? How did this come about? Basically, let me take you to a now defunct college, the Royal Army Medical College in the centre of London, next door to the Tate Gallery. Been around since Victorian times. It's now been closed again. Another little feat by Mrs. Thatcher, who had it in for a sp- Basically, I was a professor of surgery in that college. There were half a dozen other professors, academics, deans, and we sat around and said, look, guys, we get young, newly qualified MDs, grow stronger hair, and we convert them into military doctors over 6 months. We completely change their views on medicine. We also throw in what I call non-medical training, such as marching, use of weapons, escape and evasion, interrogation, all of that stuff. And the view we had was that this was really worthy of some form of academic recognition. Because at that time, in the 90s, in fact, generally true in Britain, the military had a very, very low profile. And really, I'll give you an example. My wife, I think I told the story just before, my wife went to a cocktail party, a military civil cocktail party, where one woman said, "And what is it your husband does?" And my wife said, he's an army doctor. She said, "Does that mean he can't get a proper job?" That wasn't said with any, that was just said without irony, just to, that was just a view. Really, we had approached various universities without success, and they said, look, which faculty would take this? And the answer is, this is multidisciplinary. So, one of our colleagues said, Society of Apothecary is very military-friendly, multidisciplinary, and very many of them, they run by a master and a court of assistants, very Masonic. Many of these guys are ex-military. So they said, sure, we'll take you on board, but you're not going to have a military diploma. We're going to insist, basically, that you share it with your humanitarian colleagues. And basically, the result was we called it the diploma, DMCC. That took about 4 or 5 hours. And again, how dangerous language is. The civilians in the society did not want the word military appearing in front of this because of the hostility that I've spoken about already. We wanted to get it in. So we almost broke up in disarray. But to give the society their due, once they agreed in 1993, within a year, we were examining. Now, we had no faculty at that time. We had no core curriculum. So what did we do? We simply, here's an example of something, lifted the core curriculum for training military doctors and just took the military badge off and civilianized. Same lectures, same practical training, same everything. Do we get permission? The hell we did. The society was interesting. They were very, very collaborative and said, great, we all turned up in uniform, all army, from a general down to sort of a professors, we were colonels. They were very civil to us. They said, great. They said, what we envision a diploma of this type should be one where knowledge is diffused. They actually used that word. Across the military space, the humanitarian space, and the civil space. Don't forget, the IRA had blown the shit out of London for 30-odd years. So it was a real sense of threat. And indeed, the deputy head of the Metropolitan Police, whom I used to sit with, said, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And we've now moved from the IRA to ISIL. So they said, we want to basically, they understood Semitic, we want to basically use this as a means of fostering Semitic over time. We want to foster trust, effort, and commitment, and to find the right mix of people and backgrounds to make this work. They wanted to, and they recognized, oh, wise old guys, it's going to be allowed to build itself. They're not going to impose any restrictions on it. It's going to build very slowly and organically. Let me just take you, that's just my introduction to the topic. Let me take you on the journey, because it was quite eventful. Here are the early difficulties. Military perceived to dominate. We invited NGO colleagues, humanitarian colleagues, both governmental and non-governmental, to join us. Very slow to do that. Deep suspicions. We had the tree huggers and baby easier situations. I'll give you some examples in a moment. The other thing was that, and I guess I'm a surgeon. Surgeons tend to do things quickly. They don't discuss things. It's, oh my God, what have I done? Rather than, what are we going to do? But basically, surgeons control this. A whole bunch of us, academics, senior lecturers, Navy, Army, and Air Force. And we were not going to let go. We're not very diplomatic people. So there was a very early friction between the civil military physicians, if you will, and the other specialties, not liking surgeons. I don't blame them. Also, the NGO view, the humanitarian view, was there were too many university academics who'd never been in the field in their lives. What would they know about humanitarianism? Too many grey-haired and suited men. I got one example of the caftan and open-toed sandals versus the dark suit story, which I'll tell you in a few moments, which is very common. there was certainly, we did not have enough youthful and experienced field workers for the engineering community. We asked them, they didn't come. We didn't be sick. I said, okay, sod off them. So we had huge numbers of misconceptions and misunderstandings. Let me just take you through a couple. Let me just tell you the caftan versus the dark suit. Very early on, we had a meeting, just try and blend each other. Drinks afterwards in the surroundings of the 17th century hall, silver chalices. What happened? The suits that sat there, the grey-haired professors from the military, Army, Air Force, and Navy, and the open-toed sandals, the caftan group sat over there, and they glared at each other. Mm-hmm. The presentation that was being given that time was from a SAVE person who and was on boys, child soldiers. She was a remarkable speaker, but it was an incredibly distressing presentation. People were shifting very uncomfortably in their seats. She became so distressed by her own presentation that she started to weep. If you look at the group, the humanitarians said, oh my goodness, what a poor unfortunate day. The middle thing, what the hell is she doing? One guy actually hid under the seat. He said, get her off. And it got even worse because she was so overcome and she stopped crying. She sang the remainder of her presentation. The military were just aghast. Gaping up, what on earth is this? And it was an example of the difficulty we were going to face. Elderly, suited military maintenance, and young, enthusiastic, and highly experienced humanitarians who've been out in the field. That's that story. These guys would say to us in the bar, there's no role for you people. You should not be involved in this. That changed. That was the initial feeling that when it came to humanitarian interventions, there should not be a military presence. And even one of the military guys said, "The military is the military a player, a facilitator, or the cause of the problem?" This guy called Colonel David Morgan Jones, who himself believed the military shouldn't play. And of course, this very, very, these hollowed halls, Nigel Stockton, sitting in this building in 1995, as part of a civic type presentation, said, "The military colonization by third-party military forces of humanitarian space is a creeping coup." Doesn't get more hostile than that. And here are here's a summary of the differences. Cultural differences, there's no doubt. And one of the things we learned is don't try and change that, because you won't accept it for each other. They felt that if the military would challenge their independence and they would be seen to be siding one side or the other. Issues that has been touched on already about impartiality and neutrality. Equal to the task. Some of the very, particularly MSF, some of the big NGOs, senior in the military, they think they're pretty incompetent. Mm. Assholes. Mm. Shouldn't be allowed to do it. And there's a point in that. They feel they're mission-oriented. And there's certainly big difficulties in coordination. I was in Afghanistan in the early parts, shortly after the invasion, and we tried to basically set up coordination between the military assistance groups, and we had the Finns run city because they're nice and cuddly and warm. Yeah. They're not nasty militarists. It just fell apart. One example is just maps. We asked each of them to come in with documentation, including maps of where they were, what they were supposed to do. The maps were on different scales. There was nothing. And then a guy walked in from USAID with a gun, and that was the end of it. The meeting was not deconflicted. Apolitical military goals, yes, perceived danger and using agencies as a force multiplier. Thank you, Mr. Cole, General Colin Powell. You really shafted us. not that much as core business. And of course, that doesn't help. This is basically me lying. And that doesn't help either. Mm-hmm. Racing past a lovely MSF vehicle in your tent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This does help. And this is Aceh, and this is US Navy helicopters basically providing. And also, you touched on that genuine, impressive episode about the US Navy flying into Sri Lanka and rebuilding the roads, rebuilding the railways, never interacting with the civilian population in any way, just keeping quiet to themselves. Did a fantastic job. And that heavy lift, no other organization in the world could have done that. You described coming in with the tractors and the caterpillars underneath these. So certainly in a non-conflict situation, although you can't call Sri Lanka non-conflict at that particular time, but it was non-conflict in terms of the event. But the military would kind of hit back saying, well, look, we've been doing this for centuries. Alexander the Great, Napoleon, both World Wars, the Marshall Plan, Berlin Airlift, Africa, former Yugoslavia, blah, blah, and on and on and on. So they basically were at loggerheads. But the master of the society, being an ex-military guy, said, time, effort, don't push them, let them evolve slowly, we began to build trust. Slowly we could sit in the same room without snarling at each other. We would even socialize and we had each other around to our houses to meet our spouses and had some food. It took a decade. A decade. And has it all gone? No. The better things. This civil military group, the civic group, has now evolved a curriculum which has been validated in the UK, USA and Holland by both military and civil medical authorities. We've resolved the various clashes that which exist. Inter-service, I've mentioned surgical dominance. We've now taken on board doctors and nurses and professionals allied to medicine. They're being taught alongside their medical colleagues. It's widening. It's examined in a number of countries. There's also an acceptance that the surgeons have to stand down, and in this environment, there's a different hierarchy of specialties. Public health medicine, WASH, psychology, nutrition. They have to take the lead. So the surgeons very, very gradually and very unwillingly let go of the baby. Acceptance sometimes by our civil colleagues that the military can have a role, that's growing. And certainly some of the guys have been in unintended civil military collaborations, certainly with the British, and some of our NGOs. The really important thing, and I think this is very important for the future, that our stakeholders, both civil and military, now see this as vital. Having started off by turning their nose up at it, they now, for example, in the Netherlands and in UK, demand that their military medics qualify. And if you don't have this qualification, they will hold you back from deployment. The NGOs are moving in that direction. So many of them do their own training, so they're not going to accept that easily. But at least we've got the recognition that this is academically sound, and it works, and we're developing international interest, for example. I mean, that's just making the point that, you know, mosquitoes are more important than surgical knives. Mm-hmm. Where are we now? I'll let you read that. I won't insult your knowledge, but that's basically, that is our kind of mission statement, if you will. That's what you see on our website. You see the word civil and military physicians, surgeons, dentists, and nurses. Add now to that physical therapists, nutritionists, even medical staff officers who will work as members of medical response teams. We have a course now that has been validated internationally that basically provides the knowledge base and the training. So it's not like it was in the beginning, you just rolled in and you took down lecture notes and then you kept your fingers crossed. This is now basically matured. These are the modules, if you will. Nothing surprising here. Notice that clinical knowledge is way down that list, and that's actually quite deliberate. And the last one, module 6, you can see this I think was what interested us in the very beginning, that medicine in the field, medicine in austerity, is more than medicine. This, you guys know that. Logistics, security, all of those things have to be dealt with. There we are, 20 years down the road, we've got a refined curriculum, we've got a supporting textbook, we've got increasing NGO input, and younger ones too, and women. That's the other big problem. We start off with no women. We were women free, if you will, and that sent all the wrong messages out to the people we want to sit this exam. That's now basically much better than it was. We're examining in the US, UK, and Holland. We've run demonstration courses in Ireland and the Philippines, and the Irish want to run their own course. So does Australia, the University of South Australia is going to set up and run in the autumn, and the Lebanon want demonstration courses. So it's diffusing, it's spreading from very un. That's teaching in that lovely the hall in the society, and you're just there, working with the Irish Army, helicopters, lecture theatres, and also the practical elements of it as well. So in summary, ladies and gentlemen, the experiment worked. Mm-hmm. Never intended, nobody foresaw it, but it's been basically, CEMIC has been fostered through education and knowledge diffusion. The initiative has shown that deeply rooted tensions can, with time and patience, you don't get rid of them, you simply ameliorate them, and people begin to say, I still hold the views I held at the beginning, but I respect your views too, and at least I can live with you and sit alongside you. I think it offers a model of collaboration. I've said this to Josiah before. This is an example, this happens to be a medical example. I can see this being looked at by logisticians, engineers, and team leaders. It's the same approach, sitting side by side. We're now connected internationally. We've also introduced this topic to our medical students. And it's one of the most popular courses. The Brits in this room will know that we have intercalated BSc degrees for our medical students at the end of the basic science module. We've got one in George's now, in complementary potassium medicine, and they're clamoring to get in on it. Problems? Do I see? Yes, I do. We've got this bunch of elderly guys like me who set it up, who are not going to take their hands off the terror very easily. And I'm trying to get them to obey what Max Kerman said, take kindly the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Walk away, let the young guys run it. Too many grey heads around, and we could still kill the baby yet. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. This for me, it has been extremely exciting. I would invite you all to reach out, and I am eager to develop a research stream from this. Your insights can directly spring from the work we're trying to do at Oxford, and we're eager to start contributing as well. So I'd really like this to be the inauguration of at least Oxford Humanitarian Innovation Project's engagement in the military, and I could not have asked for two better panelists to join me. So thank you.
Intelligence responses. By militaries and national governments, we are moving towards doing humanitarian intelligence. We are. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a very necessary thing. But because we have no past pedagogy, we are adopting, we're just taking agency and DIA and putting it in a humanitarian bag. We're doing it almost imperceptibly and osmotically. That needs to be intentional, challenged, and critiqued.
Tim, just very quickly, yeah. I'm curious. Let's say a leading NGO wanted to set up a forecasting center. Mm-hmm. What kind of resources are we talking? Does it need to be at the scale of TRADOC or DCDC?
Yeah, TRADOC, Training and Doctrine. So two great acronyms from the military related to your question, TRADOC and TTP, Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures. In terms of early, what we would call early warning, early response, which is intelligence. So what is the definition of intelligence? Intelligence means the collection and evaluation of information for decision-making about actions. Okay, and it's not James Bond. It means a process by which we take and evaluate. So right now there's almost zero pedagogy. I mean, we don't even, I was in University of Leiden until, Thursday night, and we were having a debate the whole time about, what do we even call this field? We were like, we want to develop a course in it. What are we, humanitarian data analysts? Yeah. Are we humanitarian forecasters? Are we people who use that watch
list? What we call it at IRC.
What watch list?
Yeah, it's just one guy and he has a subscription to. But I mean, it's someone whose job is, yeah. Like, he's a political analyst.
The humanitarian system used to have an early morning, early action subgroup that operated under the ISC, and it used to meet very regularly to look through the range of crisis settings with everyone feeding in intelligence, determining whether it was on, you know, sort of red, orange, yellow, green, you know, trends, pulling in everything from like food security data to market, you know, data to like really a big kind of picture thing. But it was under the guise of the ISC, so it didn't include all the actors.
Yeah, and when we do public health and epi, that's a pedagogy that and a lineage of learning and training that can be operationalized by humanitarians looking at FUSE, Family and Early Warning System. When we get into conflict and human security, we are making it up by the seat of our pants. Mm-hmm. And even when there has been past forecasting, it's you know, throwing all the cards on the table and seeing what sticks.
So I think actually like a big part of what struck me from the conversation is something that I think the list of things that you had about ways the military and humanitarian can interact, I think, is missing that management piece, because I really agree with what you said, that I think a lot of times, because of the history of humanitarian work, we act as if management is not a professional skill, and we act as if planning doesn't help you do things better. Something at IRC that we're trying to do is even just say, like, let's measure, so I mean, it's different, right, it's not about the military, but essentially we're just trying to say, let's measure our programming, the cost of it, the impact of it, and the management of it, and then we're trying to say, like, and managers, your job is to look at this and respond appropriately. But I think even that culture cultural shift is difficult. Some people are like, yes, I love it, that sounds great. And other people are like, that is not what I joined the humanitarian system to do. And I think that in the ways, like in the ways that we look at how we should be exchanging, for me, the processes, procedures, appreciation of training, and the psychology of running a team. I think many times what I feel really frustrated about is that people are like, oh, staff care is really important, this is really important, that is very important. But then we act as if there are not people who have been researching the way people think, feel, and react based on their thoughts and feelings for centuries, and they're called psychologists. And I think that is a huge place where humanitarians need to learn from the military and could be much more impactful than some of the product innovations.
I mean, that is at the heart of what I'm looking to do in the discussion. That's invaluable, because what we want to do is take that list that I presented, throw out things that are non-starters, and replace them with actually, you know, areas where there's a potential for diffusion. And it goes back to your point as well. I think the potential is going to be around processes. I mean, think back to log frames after action reviews. You don't need the U.S. defense budget to incorporate these things. I heard a presentation from UNDP about their new performance management system for evaluating managers. And it was like walking into a Deloitte training session. And that's not a knock against it, but they're clearly turning to the private sector and to management consultancy for referencing without becoming, hopefully, management consultants in the private sector. I don't see why there can't be a similar diffusion. But, guys, what do you think?
There needs to be a change in the way the NGOs view the world. When UCL set up its conflict recovery academic department in 1994, a very senior person from your organization rolled up and said, don't even try and look at us. Doors closed. We heard you were going to come out and look over our shoulders. No, you're not. This was a closed shop, and not just the ICRC, but many of the other NGOs were the same. So, you know, we report internally, we don't report outside, and we don't want to be looked at. Reputation funding, of course, is a big issue. But I think that's changing. I really do perceive a change now, being driven largely by donors and by the media to be much more transparent and to be measured. So I'm more hopeful than I was 20 years ago.
Oh, I don't work for ICRC, it's IRC.
Sorry.
I have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, I think we've become solutionist and product obsessed to the detriment of actual innovation. I quote Elizabeth Bishop, the American poet, all the time, bright objects hypnotize the mind. And that's been disastrous at the expense of what we really need, which has nothing to do with money and nothing to do with technology, which is process and the execution of process in a way that is routinized but also creates ambient culture. I was at this one meeting at Oxfam where he presented what we were doing with Sentinel. It was all the emergency, the HRD, Humanitarian Response Department chiefs for all the major U.S. NGOs. And we showed this image and we said, we know where your planes are when they come in to drop off food. We know where your vehicles are. And one grizzled veteran from an organization will not name a major organization says, literally, quote, dear sweet baby Jesus. It was like a clear and present danger. Where it was like, God damn it, Jack. and all they had. And I'm like, this is not going away. This is hurtling at you. Non-engagement with these capabilities that were once only the realm of military intelligence. Non-engagement compounds the things you are most worried about. And so you now need to get a process and a culture that allows you to keep your values and engage with this innovation, or your values will be gone and you won't even know, but you'll be able to say you adhere to your current paradigm. And so I couldn't agree with you more. That's the...
Fantastic. I think, you wanted to...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Why don't we take two, Evan, and then Paul, please.
Paul, you can go first.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
I think what's also missing from this conversation, and is also attributed to a lack of research, is looking from the bottom up, like you were saying, at affected communities. And so when there's direct military interaction, maybe the American Army can feed people the fastest or the most efficiently, as a UN worker told me that she witnessed on the ground in Haiti. But how are these affected communities viewing the military? And are they humanitarians or are they perceived threats? Josiah and I recently talked with someone who said that she was in West Africa and she heard people who died because they wouldn't go to an Ebola center, a treatment center that was run by the UK military because they were scared. They thought they were going to be experimented on. And so that's an area of looking that has a lot to do with effectiveness. That has to do with evaluation of impact, et cetera, that's really important because people can do all the products and processes and chain supplies, but if it's not actually helping people on the ground due to a lack of understanding of psychology, et cetera, of how people are perceiving them, that's a really big gap. And so then to make a question out of that, have either of you had firsthand experience of getting feedback of how people on the ground are responding to militaries when they're acting in a humanitarian capacity?
Very quickly, I've got a very good friend in the United States Air Force who offered a paper on the 7 sins of humanitarian medicine. One of those sins was not doing that. And he criticized the American military particularly for not doing that. He did agree that there were massive interventions by the U.S. Navy every summer with the big hospital ships Mercy and Comfort. But they were kind of, he called it a reward punishment. They arrived in a particular port, did some dentistry, did some glasses, and then pissed off, never came back again. So they left a very angry, disillusioned, and the reverse of what they intended. The British don't even bother. You mentioned the British in Syria, with the British military involved in the Ebola crisis, doing some superb work. But as you say, it's a colonial legacy here. They're feared. And they also were operating in Sierra Leone quite recently in support of the government, who were not very popular. And they were involved in shooting. So now they're offering aid. You know, there's a real image problem.
Perception.
I don't know how to get rid of the perception. Which we'll need to grasp that nettle at some stage.
Yeah, I would just, a quick anecdote, something we've studied a lot in looking at drones is legacy of U.S. airdropping in Afghanistan in the early phase of the war, and MREs, and just three funny stories, because I was in Pakistan and Tajikistan during that time, three funny stories, well, tragic funny. One is, you know, people were reported coming across the border having taken the plastic coverings and used them as shoes, and this leads somewhere, but because they weren't eating what the food provided was, because it contained peanut butter. And so they didn't know if it was going to poison them, so they were feeding it to their donkeys to see what would happen. On the sad part, that was a public affairs effort. It was a flash in the pan. That humanitarians were saying, we know how to do this, we are doing this, we're going overland, you don't need to do an airdrop. You're doing an airdrop for hearts and minds. So that's an important moment when humanitarians have to manage up to militaries, and if you don't tell them, you don't engage with them positively, then it just becomes a public spat and not an operational adjustment saying, you do this, X is going to happen. So what happened? Two pallets didn't open, and one came crashing down and killed at least one kid through the roof of a house.
Which leave that Haiti as well.
Yeah. So, and the point is that militaries also need us, and we need them to need us in one critical way, which is we know what works for long-term sustained presence, and they will lean towards high-impact, high-speed kinetic methods that allow them to then rapidly pull out. And when that happens, that's where you do have collateral casualties, not just a pallet coming through the house, but people not being reached appropriately, both for perception optics, but also for delivery modality.
That's good time for one more.
Okay, thanks. I think this has been a really very interesting, very helpful. One thing you haven't touched on that has become a real focus in our work has been the indirect effects of war. That there's been a lot of focus on the direct exposure to trauma through combat operations and the reduction of civilian casualties, but far less on the indirect effects of availability of food, the collapse of medical infrastructure, electric grids, hospital capabilities, and the potential for people like us to better inform and elevate the impact of the nature and the precision of combat operations to reflect concern for indirect effects as much as direct effects. And the military has had no interest nor capability to assess the indirect effects. And the humanitarian world, when they have tried to do this, sometimes done it well, it's been a bit relatively isolated and controversial, because of its isolation. Particularly given new capabilities and new technical abilities, do we have the opportunity, if not the responsibility, to quantify better, to create a taxonomy that would be useful, and actually engage with the military to provide greater guidance and insight in targeting and the precision of targeting to avoid the indirect effects that we're now trying to deal with through humanitarian action?
It should happen, but I'm not optimistic. Part of the reason that I'm not optimistic is the nature of modern conflict. It's asymmetric, it's technocentric, it's also protracted. You take a country like Iraq, which was, according to a UN report in the 1960s, was equivalent to the healthcare system of a modern European state. A combination of sanctions and the use of modern weapons has not only has it utterly destroyed an assistant of healthcare in the south just as the war ended, destruction of hospitals, destruction of primary care clinics, also the destruction of their system. So they had a superb reporting system, epidemiology, all gone. This was a complete takeout of a country's infrastructure, its healthcare system. They went from being equivalent to Switzerland, as was said, to being one of the worst in the world. And it's not getting any better. So I think there's a moral and ethic, there's a legal, moral, and ethical obligation to do it. That's right. But I just don't see it being done. The NGOs can't do it. It's just too damn dangerous out on the ground. The military, I think, might say, good idea, but if you're right to raise it, I think it's right. Because the rage and hostility that engenders among civilian populations, I go back to forced to Iraq quite a lot, and just below the surface there is absolute rage and hatred among the medical community.
I think that there's an order of operations chain that needs to be established with staging to help inform militaries and other actors as they develop concepts of operation before a mission. Okay. There's a whole chain here. I'm going to ignore it. I'm just going to talk about the initial targeting phase. I think to bite off one piece of the apple, initial target planning is something where there needs to be an open discussion in a very safe place. And hopefully from that we can develop common, for humanitarians and planners, a list of stuff you need to be doing and thinking about. For example, to Jim's point, two horrible things happened in the first 48 hours of the air campaign in Iraq. One, we took out the power. Great. But that caused all the pumping stations for water and sewage to stop. And so the WATSAN teams on the ground said, we had no idea that suddenly human waste was going to come shooting out of everywhere. And they had no game plan on that. They didn't understand that that was an inevitable when you bring in what the Americans were going to bring in to knock out critical command and control. Second is all the blood supplies in the entire country, boom, gone, because it killed the refrigeration. No one thought about that. So basically the Oxfam team's on the ground, like, literally, they're calling, we're up to our waist and shit, and there's no blood or medical supplies. And there was 48 hours ago, the exact opposite. And so I'm just saying, if we could start there, that's something that affects everyone, which is, hey, if you're going to knock out command and control and you're going to knock out cell towers,
you have to have a follow-on. And then for humanitarians, they need to be told, okay, when you give us this target or location to not hit, here's some things you can expect to happen or not happen.
I just said that I think there's a point here about R&D and design. We mentioned this the other day. Toxic remnants of war is a very underexplored area, but often the shell casings, the weapon systems that they use in these conflict armies, they poison or provide depleted uranium that can have health risks and knock-on effects for decades afterwards. It's still a major issue in Kosovo. Can that be avoided through the design of different... the U.S. military is moving away from depleted uranium shells. Is that motivated in any way by perceptions on the ground? I think it's a matter of making that the strategic impact. So from the start through targeting and all the way down the chain. I think we have time for one
minute.
Nope. No more. I'm very bad at this.
I feel like the census stop.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you so much for attending.